So a quick question for you. What is the bleakest, most depressing work of literature that you've read? Or that you know of? What do you... For the pregnant lady in the back, I will repeat the question. What is the bleakest or the most depressing work of literature that you've either read or you know of?
Anything
male. Anything
male? Oliver Twist.
Oliver Twist, okay.
1984,
yes. That's pretty dark.
American Psycho.
American Psycho. Yeah, yeah, I haven't read it, but yes, I've heard great things.
Anything from Jane Austen.
Anything from Jane Austen?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that because it's, yeah, bleak?
It's bleak, yeah.
Trisha?
It's one of my favourite.
Yes, Alone in Berlin. Yeah, seen the film,
yeah,
but not the book.
Like Archie Lego from Souls in Its Sleep, because all they did was move from Siberian camp to Siberian camp.
Anything by Souls in Its Sleep, I think, is pretty dark, as well as Dostoevsky as well. So.
Yeah, Antigone.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I know. So there's some pretty dark stuff out there. For my O-levels, so how old I am, and my A-levels, we did Test of the D'Urbervilles, which is pretty bad, 1984, and Death of a Salesman, Martha Miller. I mean, by the end, I was, you know, it was a dark period of literature, and a dark period. I mean, roll those three books out for a kid in his 16, 17, 18. It's sort of like, well, I want some light relief here. And introduced this world of suicide and all sorts of, you know, depressing things and violence and everything else like this. Well, it's a wake-up call, of course. But, yes, well, added to that list could be Ecclesiastes, the book that we're going to embark on a new series today, because Ecclesiastes is a book for our time, certainly. And of all the works of literature in the world, all the things which we think are dark and sinister and depressing, I mean, I'm surprised you didn't say the Reform Manifesto in that list, or any transcript of Donald Trump's speeches or anything that comes out of his mouth. But Ecclesiastes wrestles with many, many big questions, and these are relevant for our time. Questions such as, does life have meaning? Can we be happy? How do we live well? What is the good life? And how do we navigate death and chance? These are all things that we are going to wrestle with, because they are society's questions. They are a 21st century question, as they were a first century and before that. And Ecclesiastes is a unique voice in biblical literature. In the wisdom literature, which is generally Proverbs, you could say Song of Songs, but Proverbs and Job, and Ecclesiastes is part of that. And it is a unique voice amongst that, because it asks a lot more difficult questions. It is obscure, provocative, haunting, charming in places, raw, melancholy. When I was talking a little bit about a few weeks ago, Paul said it was grungy, and grungy it is a good way to describe it. And probably it is the Bible book that gets the closest to some kind of philosophy, some kind of rigorous intellectual thinking, as well as practice about what life is and the meaning of life. And so we're going to embark on this journey, and all the words that I'm going to quote, you can turn in the book, actually. I'm not sure what the page number is for the Ecclesiastes. Has it all gone here? What's happened here? What number is it? 670, yes. Yeah. So you can follow in the Bibles there, but all the words will be on the screen. They are a different translation that we're using in the New International Version, but it's always good to look at different translations of the Bible as we go along. So this starts, the very first verse of chapter 1 is the words of Coheleth, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Now, these words have been translated the reflections of the royal philosopher, the words of the teacher. Coheleth is a person, essentially the meaning of that word is someone who brings people together, The Bible Project calls him the critic. And so it is not a name, it's a title. Colette is the protagonist of the book. He's anonymous, and he's more than just a teacher. He's a pleasure seeker. He's a sage. He's a sentinel over life. He's a disruptor. He's a, you could call him, he's a tells it like it is northerner. He's the guy that is brash and tells it like it is, you know. I ain't going to be, you know. Well, that's not northern. No, it's not. But he's a brash East Ender then, or a northerner. I mean, I'll just speak how I speak. And you say, I say Bath, you say Bath, don't you, Chrissy?
I do say Bath.
Yeah, yeah, you do. Nothing against West Sussex accents, of course.
East.
No,
it's
everywhere.
East, yes. East or Sussex, you know. Sussex is one big county, it's all fine.
Sorry.
Okay, we have some East and Sussex. Anyway. So he's a tells it like it is sort of guy, rough around the edges, not prepared to speak in less than raw, honest terms. He's a straight talker, unfiltered, and he tells life like it is as he observes it. But he's also playful, and playful in a way which gets us thinking. And one of the writers I've been looking at is a guy called Bobby Jameson that's written this book, Everything Is Never Enough. And he talks about how Koheleth is this playful actor, this sentinel over life, which is looking at life and purveying it and seeing it and then not just dipping into it, but immersing himself. And how this becomes a very playful, almost comic act. And he quotes the words of Jerry Seinfeld, Seinfeld's description of being a father as a way to say how this description of life and his immersion in life is playful and comic. And these are the words. When I say I love being a parent, I certainly don't mean to give you an impression that I am in any way effective at it. I tell my kids to do things, but they say no. And so I have been reduced to threats, fear and intimidation. I have become a small-time mob boss around my house. I figure out what they like and then threaten to hurt those things. I notice you're becoming quite fond of that little scruffy curious George that sits in the corner of your room. It would certainly be a shame if something were suddenly to happen to him. He sits very close to the stairwell. And with you being at nursery school all day, he seems vulnerable. I was just looking at the box that he came in, and I think I noticed the words flammable. So, a dark edge to Jerry Sinfield's understanding of what it means to be a parent. And we could all equate to that. This is a guy who calls himself the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Now, if you were here a few weeks ago, I stated very clearly that this is not Solomon. This is a person that is assuming a Solomon-like persona, a royal king persona, because of the language and the understanding of the words of the text. They believe were written at least 600 years after the period of Solomon's reign and kingship. So he is reimagining what a wise, resourceful, wealthy king would do and say as he immerses himself in all of life. And Koheleth also is a character in the book because the author introduces the character Koheleth, and that's all we're going to call him. We're not going to call him the teacher or the critic or the philosopher because he's all those things. And at the end, in chapter 12, the author summarizes the understanding of Koheleth's vision and prescription of life. So I ask you a question this morning. How are you feeling today? How are you feeling? Do you feel optimistic, worn down, steady, curious, sad, Alex, cynical, hopeful for the new season? I'd like to just point out an Arsenal fan just like that, but, you know, at this time you've got to own it. You may be thinking all of those things all at the same time. Last year I I had my 60th birthday, and many of you know I did these first things that I've never done before, sort of 60 new things that I haven't done before. And one of the things that we went on was we went to a Hackney rooftop sauna. And not only was the sauna looked out on sort of East London, but you also went into these plunge pools, like a plunge bath. And one of these showers where you pull a, you know, you pull the chain and this ice bath pours all over you, and it's very, very cold and very, very shocking. I've got this video of, I did it, and I've got this video of Lorna, and I didn't want to show it because I don't think Lorna wanted to see it all in the glory, but she pulls this cord and she's absolutely freezing. Now I tell her to get into the bath. She says, I don't want to go in the bath. I said, get in the bath. And she gets in the ice cold bath and it's absolutely freezing. And one of the things that I did do during that year, apart from that, was to swim in the sea every month. And this is a picture of when we went to the Bristol Channel in January, when it was about 4 degrees in the water. And that's me and Joss coming out absolutely freezing. And this is Lorna sitting in there after the ice-cold plunge bath. And in some ways, reading this book, reading the words of Scripture and the observations that we're going to look at, is like being plunged into an ice-cold bath, the icy seas, because it is a shock to the body. It's arresting to our senses, but also slightly invigorating at the same time. There's something shocking that arrests us, but actually something that sort of like moves us and makes us feel okay, obviously when we get out rather than when we're in the midst of it. And so as we plunge ourselves into the icy cold bath of Ecclesiastes, we've got to join in with Coelette's understanding of what the questions of the meaning of life are, and to grapple with his conclusion, which is the second verse of the book, which says, Hevel, says Coelette, utter Hevel, everything is Hevel, or Hebel, you can pronounce it both ways. Hevel is 38 times in the book is mentioned this word. It's a strange word. 50% of the total usages of that word in the whole of the Old Testament are used in the book of Ecclesiastes. So it has significance. Hevel has been translated in various Bibles as meaninglessness, vanity in the older versions of the King James Version. But it is a slippery word when it comes to understanding what it means. It can be translated in the Hebrew a whole number of things, and therefore when we reduce it to just to one word like meaninglessness or vanity, we lose some of the depth and the richness of what this word Hevel actually is. And there are two major understandings to what it is. First of all, it is about meaninglessness, absurdity, hollowness, futility, but it's also vapour. It's mist, it's breath, it's something which is here today and gone tomorrow. So life is, according to Coelette, it is pointless, absurd, futile, but it's also insubstantial as smoke. It's temporary as mist, it's flimsy as hot air, and it's transient as a bubble that just bursts just like that. So it cannot be grasped or controlled. It's elusive and incomprehensible. So Hevel is all of these things. It's both of these things. And interestingly, the word Hebel is closely related as a Hebrew root word to the word able. Now, why do you think that is? Why is Hevel and Abel linked together? You remember Abel, the character in Genesis? Because the author is trying to understand how the fate of Abel, the brother of Cain that was so needlessly and randomly and senselessly murdered, his life was a vaporous life. It just disappeared in a moment, and his death was senseless. And those root words is the way to try and bring the idea of life being like that in the word Abel, Hevel and Abel linked together. And so Abel, and the life and death of Abel is the kind of data that Qohelet is trying to wrestle with in terms of life. And so perhaps a good summary of all this is to mean that Hevel is breath, vapour, smoke, but all of life is a baffling enigma. So if to bring those two meanings together, life is a baffling enigma. And it's not just life, but is actually all of life. All of life. All, or everything, is used 90 times in Ecclesiastes. 40% of the 222 verses in Ecclesiastes is the word all. So it's quite significant in terms of how we understand what Qohelet is trying to say. And he asks this question: what do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? And this question is an icy cold summary of Qohelet's search for meaning that frames the whole of the book. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? And so he dives into this extensive, full diary of events and experiences. And he comes to this conclusion. And it's quite shocking for an audience at that time, for a person of such wisdom and resources and status and wealth, to conclude that all of life is vapour and absurd. Because after all, somebody surely with enough status and wealth and acclaim and power and money can see life from a different perspective. So it's shocking for them to hear that life for someone in that realm sees life as an absurdity. But that, at the same time, that conclusion is not a closed statement. It's a chance to open up the debate about what life is really about. And we are called to assemble with Qohelet. He's an assembly of people. He gathers people together and he speaks to them about what he's learned. And so we are gathered, society, Christians, the church in the 21st century, to listen to the truths of his claims, to listen to his observations, and we're invited to share in his existential crisis. That's what we're going to share in. This, we're going to participate in how he is feeling. So, I ask the question again, how are you feeling this morning? And do you feel any better for coming to church? Now, he says these words, life under the sun of which people toil. Basically, that means anything in heaven and earth that we experience. Where the sun shines is where life happens. It's the universal experience of everything that we do. It is like someone saying, why on earth did you do that? What on earth are you doing? As if to say, of all the things on earth you can do, you decide to do that very thing. It's the kind of question that Lorna asks me every day. Why on earth are you doing that? What on earth have you done? You stupid idiot. So, we have this idea that Qohelet launches himself into this tirade of metaphors and reasons why there is no profit, no gain of life under the sun. Because then he goes on to say, look out of the window, observe life and see what I'm talking about. So he says these. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning to its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the earth is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome. More than I can say, more than he can say even. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its hearing. This is the idea, and actually on this translation, they have got it a little bit wrong in the sense of the generations. He actually says the generations goes and comes. So he actually starts with death rather than comes and goes. The idea that he starts with death as the thing that is the most vaporous enigma that life is, and life is circular. We die, we're born, we die, we're born, and that's on repeat. The sun sets and then rises, and the wind blows in the north and south, and it just round and round and round. Nature just goes round in this circularity of boredom and monotony, and there's no innovation or change in nature. It just happens like this all the time. The river flows into the sea, and the sea doesn't turn around to say, I'm full now, you can stop. It just goes to the same thing. There is no goal or purpose to nature, Coelette says, and it is like a repetitive cycle of futile activity, like walking up a down escalator. And Coelette says, human history, human experience, and life is like the natural world. Our lives follow the earth's boring monotony of repetition, futile work without gain. How many of us think about that, our work like that? Hey? So we can echo some of Coelette's thoughts. Long periods of circularity where nothing is new, just merely repeated under the sun. And everything, he says, is wearisome. All my eyes and all that I can hear, it just ties me out because I'm seeing the same thing, I'm hearing the same thing all the time. And anyway, he goes on to say, is there anything of which can say, look, this is something new. It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and yet even those yet to come will not be remembered by those that follow them. So not only is it just go round and round, but nobody's ever going to remember you. You're here on earth and then you die and then you'll be forgotten completely. I mean, it is pretty depressing, isn't it? When we're in Australia and we're walking through this rainforest and these trees that have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I actually had this sort of thought. I thought, well, you know, we're stepping on the ground now, but we'll be gone soon, you know. And these rainforests will be here, hopefully, for centuries and centuries. And the people that have passed these trees and looked up and meditated and reflected and enjoyed them, well, they're all forgotten. They're forgotten people. Nobody knows their names. They're gone and we will be gone. And this is the depressing thought that he puts, that we will not be remembered. And thinking about my own, because some people do like delving into their family history, and I came to the shocking conclusion that actually I don't even know the names of three of my grandparents. I don't even know their names. I had one grandparent when I was alive, Doris, Gailey we used to call her. She died when I was 21. But my dad's parents, they died when he was 12, so I didn't know their name. And my other grandparent, which was my mum's dad, died before I was born. And I realised that actually I didn't know their names. I didn't even know their names. And that's like one generation after my mum and dad. You think to yourself, forgotten. I mean, I might have been told them a long time ago. Obviously, I'm not discounting that. But I can't remember who they were. And that's my own family.
What are your cousins' names?
I don't know. what are their names? You know. So, but I mean, that's more dimension than that's their names. But I have met them a couple of times. They're in Scotland. So this quest for meaning, this interrogation of life, fills his waking moments. And he goes on to say these words here. I, Coelette, was king over in Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom, all that is done under the heavens. It is a bad business God has given human beings to be busy with. I have seen all things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, are chasing after the wind. Something crooked cannot be straight. Something lacking cannot be counted. I have said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this is too chasing after the wind. Because with the abundance of smartness, there is much vexation. And no one increases knowledge increases pain. And everyone who increases knowledge increases pain. So I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects and built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flock than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater far more than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. Denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labour, and this was the reward for my toil. Wow. Someone that experienced everything that one could do with the resources that he had. Food, money, sex, wine, building projects, all sorts of wisdom and learning. He did not withhold any pleasure from what his eyes desired. And yet, he comes to the conclusion, was I satisfied? Did I find meaning? No, it was just a chasing after the wind. Have you ever chased after the wind? It's a hard task. It's a meaningless task. This is the power of Hevel, the power of absurdity. And so this was an ambitious project for a king or a person in this kingly persona. Because kings in the ancient Near East loved to think of themselves as people that innovate, people that create, people that build, people that push boundaries of building projects and palaces and technology and human achievement. And he takes on this persona for that purpose. But even for royalty, he's saying, there is nothing new. My pursuit of pleasure that knew no bounds has just brought me depression and toil and meaningless vapour and absurdity. And so we ask ourselves, is this a window into the 21st soul of humanity? It is a window into our own soul in any humanity, in any era. The universe, universal quest for meaning. And the fact is that you could look at him and you think to yourself, this guy is either an agnostic or he's an atheist. But he believes in God. He believes in a divine, transcendent sense or being or purpose or something. But he's not afraid at the same time to bring the divine into the realm of his speculation and to being almost complicit in life's burdensome task. It's a bad business God gave human beings to be busy with. It's a bad business. And something is radically bent, crooked about the world, he says. Now, I could say, before you get depressed about this, but you may already be, we've got to acknowledge the claims that Coelette is making about life and see the paradoxes that exist in the whole book, and we'll explore some of those another time. Because there are many things that are quite confusing in the whole of the book that we think he seems to state something, and then he says something completely opposite. For example, so the question, is it good to work? Well, in chapter 3 and verse 3, and we'll pass this, it is God's gift that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in their toil. So it is good to work, of course. It's God's gift. But then he says, no, it's not. What do people get for all their toil and anxious striving for which they labour under the sun? All their days their work is grief and pain. Even at night their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. But it's also God's gift at the same time. What's going on there? Is it good to be rich? Of course it is. Every man also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and find enjoyment in his tool, this is the gift of God. Yes, riches are great, wealth, excellent. No, they're not. Ecclesiastes 5. The sleep of the labourer is sweet, whether they eat little or much. But as for the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners. Is it good to be righteous? Well, of course, we think it's good to be righteous, and so does Coelette. For the man who pleases him, God, gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But Ecclesiastes says, 7, in this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these, the righteous perishing in their righteousness and the wicked living long in their wickedness. Do not be over-righteous, neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself? Why destroy yourself to be so righteous and over-wise? Is it good to have relationships? Relationships with a woman in this case. Enjoy life with a woman whom you love all the days of mere breath that God has given you under the sun. Yes, relationships, great. I find more bitter than death the woman who is a snare, whose heart is a trap and whose hands are chains. The man who pleases God will escape her. What is he saying? If life is a baffling enigma, so it seems is Coelette's observations about life. But perhaps that is the point. Perhaps the point is that in his vexed, contradictory conclusions, we realise we're not going to get from him some neat solutions. We're not going to get some pithy proverbs, some clear explanations of life, of life's absurd vapour. See, if Coelette was walking down the high street and he went into Clinton Cards and he looked over the segment about those, you know, they have posters on their wall giving nice, you know, grand statements about life and happy birthday and happy anniversary and all these lovely sayings about love. And he would go round and say, that's bull. That's bull. That's a load of tosh, that is. That's bull. That's bull. Because he would go round thinking, what you are saying is so different from how life actually is. But then one moment he may come in another day and go into Scribbler and say, oh yeah, that's quite a good saying about work and about retirement and about having a birthday and having a celebration. I love that. That's excellent. Who is this guy? His role is to poke and to prod conventional wisdom. And that is part of our task as well as we read this book. It is a test to the assembled masses. What is life about? And to put a search light on it. He goes on to say, Coelette searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. This is the author writing these things. The words of the wise are like goads. Their collected sayings like nails fixed in prodding sticks, given by one shepherd. So a shepherd's goad was a way to poke and to prod to get people, to get the sheep to move. So he was able to poke and prod into conventional wisdom. So all the sayings that we experience in life, all the explanations of life, he comes along and says, no, it's bull. It's rubbish. Doesn't make sense. So he's always poking and prodding even Israelite wisdom, Jewish wisdom, about what life and God even and what faith is all about. And we can see the contradictions that Ecclesiastes and Coelette's thoughts are compared to, say, the book of Proverbs. You see, Proverbs, on one hand, says that we can delight in God's good creation. Yes, God's good creation. Fantastic. Look at the seas and the rivers and the fields and the sky and the moon and the stars, and we can celebrate them. Coelette throws a grenade into that wisdom. He smashes it all up and he's not afraid to burst people's bubble. He says, no, God's creation is random. It has no point to it. It has no goal. It's futile absurdity. Proverbs says very clearly that diligence and hard work is a virtue and it will bring success. Coelette says it only brings madness and folly, and you are a fool to do it. There's no benefit and gain in it whatsoever. One of the things about Israelite wisdom, Jewish wisdom, Hebrew wisdom, is the imagination that you will be remembered into generation after generation after you die. And that is, therefore, a blessing to be named in the generation's words and stories, that you'll be remembered that way. That is your immortality. That is your eternity, to be heard and remembered. And to be forgotten is the ultimate curse. And so when he comes along and says, ah, you'll be forgotten anyway once you're dead, you're not going to be remembered, it's an icy cold bath. They suddenly come and thinking, no, surely, I want to be remembered. And so the Hebrew belief that you can transcend death by being remembered is put under scrutiny itself. So, and we're going to pause for a couple of minutes before we finish. How do we discern the truth and the authority of Coelette's wisdom and observations? For a couple of minutes, I want you to just discuss on your tables very simply, what is the first thoughts of your concerns about some of the claims that Coelette is making about life? What is your first reaction to what are these claims are about life, that it's vapor, that work is good but it's also bad, that wealth is good but it's also terrible and evil? Just discuss very briefly on your tables, and then we may have a little bit of feedback, then I'm just going to conclude. So the question we need to ask ourselves when we're reading this book is, what do we do with his wisdom? How reliable is his voice? And that might be quite hard for some people, some Christians, to try and understand when we say, well, it's sacred scripture, it's inspired. It must be authoritative. But how can we rely on this voice? Well, first of all, we've got to say that our faith ought to be challenged by the absurd reality that Coelette sees in life. And whilst we can understand with Coelette that life is both mystery and mist, absurd vapour, and hard to control and grasp, at the same time, we've got to say, paradoxically to that, the same as Coelette, that life is also a gift from God, because that's what he says. He says that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and their ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, this is the gift of God. So splattered around his thinking about absurdity and meaninglessness and vapour and futility at the same time is that somehow life is a gift from God. So how do we reconcile with those things? And we cannot and should not massage our post-Jesus experience into these absurd claims. We can't just shoehorn Jesus in to say, oh, it'll be all okay and God is in control. Because God is not in control. And that is one of the cliches that we have to dismantle and disrupt in the whole of this process, along with a whole number of other religious, quasi-religious, superficial claims, post-Jesus, post-resurrection, post-ascension, post-coming of the Holy Spirit. And we cannot just say it'll all be good in the end, because I don't think that's Coelette's claim. He leaves us on a cliffhanger. And we have to sit with the uncomfortable experience that Coelette is in, but we still can read it in the light of Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension. Of course we can, but we can't just massage that into everything and say it'll be all right in the end, but life really does have meaning. And our journey, therefore, is his journey. His quest for meaning is our quest for meaning. His dark place is our dark place. And so we join with him as co-wrestlers, co-philosophers, co-interrogators of life, as we shuffle through the complexities of life with Coalette. And that involves rigorous thinking and feeling about this absurd vapour. And so therefore we can say this text is sacred and inspired, but we should also interrogate it in terms of its reliability and its voice and its authority. One thing we could say is Coalette laments the fact that the created order does the same thing over and over again. Well, we delight in the fact that's that what we want. In a time of climate breakdown, we're scared that creation is doing something different now. We want it to be stable. We want it to carry on doing the thing, the sun setting and the rivers and the seas, having the same level of input and output. And because we get scared when the seas are rising, the temperatures are rising, because change is happening and change is not meant to be happening in terms of the level it is. And so that is something that we are dealing with that Coalette knows nothing about and speaks of an era and a time that doesn't know anything about nature and sciences the way that we do it. And so when we conclude about what we are wrestling with and who we are wrestling with in terms of Coalette, we can say we can agree with you on many, many things, but also we've got to say, hang on a minute. Our life, our experience post-Jesus, with Jesus, sheds some new dimensions onto your claims. And so therefore, we've got to start wrestling with him and his claims as well. Whilst at the same time saying, it's an enigma, but it's a gift. In the flimsy vapour of 21st century life, we might well conclude that finding meaning is chasing after the wind. But in the tension between mist and meaning, between gift and chaos, between hope and despair, between Arsenal winning the title and losing the Champions League final, because that is a perfect metaphor for triumph and despair that happens in a moment, there is the sacred task of discerning wisdom, and that is the duty of all Christians in the first century and before that and in the 21st century, and that is what we will embark on in the next few weeks. I just want to read to you as we close a poem, prayer, and let's use this as a way to round off some of the things we've been thinking about and as a way to give these thoughts and these words to God as we finish. Ecclesiastes leans over the balcony of time and laughs softly. Vanity of vanity, says the tired voice of wisdom. And I answer back like a stubborn apprentice. Yeah, but I'm still in the search for meaning. So I swallowed pleasure whole. I built mansions for myself while my soul slept in the scaffolding. I planted gardens to hide the grave beneath the roses. Silver filled my rooms, but it could not pay off death. Wisdom lit a candle in the dark, and then the wind came. I drank wine beneath the cedar beams and still woke thirsty. For man cannot hold tomorrow. His days scatter like ash from a cigarette outside the kingdom gates. The rich rot, the wise fade, the fool sleeps beside them underground without distinction. Yet you, terrible and beautiful God, hide little eternities inside ordinary things. Hot coffee at dawn, oil on tired skin, friends roaring alive around a broken table, music shaking grief from old cathedral bones. Teach me the sacrifice of enough. Teach me to love the hour before it dies. Teach me to kneel before small joys. without trying to cage them forever. Because time devours everything. Lovers, empires, song, teeth. And still the heart reaches upwards, like a flower growing through cracked concrete. For these brief pleasures, the meal, the garden, the body, the song, are wild little gifts from your hand, burning from one impossible moment beneath the exhausted sun. If this is vanity, let it be a holy vanity. So I will eat, I will drink, I will work beneath the failing sun, I will bless the fleeting day you handed me, O God, like a match burning in cold hands. And when the dark finally calls my name, let me go laughing, grateful for the terrible gift of being alive at all. Amen.